have a friend at Palmer's Green URC who really likes climbing mountains. And it was actually quite some time ago now that he told me he'd managed to get to the top of 124 of what are called the Munros, which are mountains in the United Kingdom which are more than 3,000 feet high. I believe he also energetically went on one of those weekends where you rush around trying to climb the highest peak in Wales, in England, and in Scotland. And I don't know quite how long that takes, but I think you spend a weekend actually doing it. I have to confess that I've only been right to the top of one mountain in the UK, and that's Snowdon. And I didn't walk up it, I took the railway, which is a much more relaxing way of getting there. But in the Bible, many significant events actually take place on the top of mountains, and we can find that throughout the scriptures. There's an account in Genesis of Abraham and Isaac, which comes to its climax on Mount Moriah. And that's often thought to be the site of the temple in Jerusalem that was later built by Solomon. It's certainly in the same area as Calvary. And so it's fascinating to look forward perhaps 2,000 years from that point where God saves Isaac by providing a sacrifice to the point where he saves us by providing Jesus, his own son, as the sacrifice. Other significant events also take place on mountains, as the giving of the law to Moses, for example. There's Elijah's conflict with the prophets of Baal, which took place on Mount Carmel. The ark comes to rest on the top of a mountain. In the New Testament, we have temptation on a mountaintop. We have a sermon on a mountaintop. And those events are all significant, but none of them are exactly mysterious. Whereas this particular one, called the Transfiguration, does have that air of mystery about it. And it's interesting that by tradition, it's celebrated on the same day by both the Eastern and Western churches. For some reason, that happens to be August the 6th. Quite how that tallies with us having the lectionary reading somewhat before Easter, I'm not sure. But the real question that we must ask, surely, about this event is, what does it actually mean? But if we discover the meaning of something, we need to just look carefully at what actually happened first. Now, we're not going to get a complete answer because we only have a limited amount of detail in this passage. But we can note a few things, especially if we cross-reference with the corresponding passage in Mark and Luke. In Luke, we see a particular place mentioned, which is Caesarea Philippi. That's in verse 27 of chapter 8. In both Matthew and in Luke, there's a time scale, 6 days later. And then Luke's account gives us more information about what Jesus was doing there. He was actually praying at the time that he was transfigured in this way. And we know from other accounts, it was Jesus' habit to go apart to actually pray. Thirdly, the events follow both Matthew and Mark, recording that Jesus started to talk about his suffering and his death. And all of these things taken together confirm that this was actually a real event. It isn't a post-resurrection appearance read back in time for some reason. It's not symbolic narrative. It's a real event in Jesus' earthly life that is being described here. And one of the essential doctrines of Christianity is that Jesus was both fully man and fully God. Now, of course, we can't fully understand that, but it is something that we need to believe because that's what the Bible teaches us. But of course, his divinity is somewhat veiled when he's here on earth. We have a hymn that the first line goes, "From heaven you came," and it's popularly called the Servant King. And it says he came not to be served, but to serve. And what here three of his closest disciples for a brief while see is that veil pulled back. They see something of the glory that Jesus shares with God. And that's apparent in the way that his face and his clothes shine in an unearthly way. Now, at this particular time, Jesus is on a mountain. It's probably Mount Hermon, which we know to be 9,200 feet high. It might not have been right at the top, but I don't know whether you are aware of at what point we normally get permanent snow on mountains, but in most cases it's somewhere around 7,000 feet and upwards you get permanent snow. And so there have been permanent snow, so it must have been somewhat of a really impressive sight to see this dazzling white against the snow. And yet Jesus is there to pray. He's already started to talk about his coming suffering and death. And perhaps he needs to be sure that his planned trip to Jerusalem is the right thing. In a way, he already knew the answer, of course, just as he did in Gethsemane when he asked if it's possible for the cup to be taken away. And yet, since he's human, he's somehow seeking the Father's confirmation at a critical point. And of course, it may well have been one of those experiences that he also wanted his disciples to understand and be sure of. And the appearances of Moses and Elijah there speaking to Jesus are recorded, but there's no details given in Matthew or in Mark. But in Luke, we see that they're talking about his coming death in Jerusalem. No doubt Jesus is receiving encouragement and support from them. And those two characters are uniquely qualified to give that support because they both experienced a sense of isolation in their leadership. Remember how Moses was often on his own trying to battle for the people of Israel, how Elijah was often on his own being pursued by Ahab or Jezebel. But together they represented God's word to Israel. And there's something unusual about them as well, if you remember the accounts. Moses is said to have been buried by God, and his body was never found. Elijah is described as having been taken up into heaven by fiery chariots and horses. Now put yourself in that position. The disciples were understandably frightened by what they witnessed because they couldn't understand it. And of the three of them, I think we'd all plump for Peter being the first one to actually speak, and indeed it is. And his words do perhaps indicate that there's fear as well as a sense of wonder. But there's also a desire to capture that mountainside experience in that suggestion of making tents for Elijah and Moses and Jesus. And that response adds to the sense that this is a real event. It's so ordinary, so typically Peter. And if we ask why the disciples are allowed or needed to see this event, there are two obvious answers. Firstly, someone needed to witness it to be able to tell people later on. Secondly, it would have been a moment that they would have remembered, a moment that would have encouraged them, convinced them of who Jesus was and where the future lay. And then no sooner has Peter spoken than God himself appears in a cloud and speaks to them all. And the presence of God is regularly connected with a cloud. Remember, it was a cloud that led the people of Israel, for example. In the cloud that Moses met God, in the cloud that God came to the tabernacle. It was cloud that filled the temple of Solomon when it was dedicated. But here it was just a way of saying that the Messiah had come. And there are just three occasions in the Gospels when God speaks directly to those who are around Jesus. At his baptism, here, and once in Jerusalem, as recorded in John chapter 12. Each time it's not a long speech, it's just a few words confirming who Jesus is and that God is pleased with him. And he tells the disciples to listen to him. Then suddenly, that moment has gone. And Jesus forbids his disciples to speak of what they've seen until he has risen from death. And that's not difficult to understand because the popular conception of the Messiah was more of a military one than the role that Jesus actually played. If they told this story, then that would inflame those feelings. And Jesus didn't want that. He knew that he hadn't come as a conquering king, but as a suffering servant. However, it is especially significant that they will in the future be able to tell others, as we read in 2 Peter. Up to this point in Mark's Gospel, for example, there have been no less than 7 different occasions when he is recorded as telling people and demons not to tell others what they have seen or know. And this whole experience is significant for Jesus because it confirms that he's taking the right path, following his Father's will. It's significant for those disciples because they will have something to hold on to and look back to in the dark days to come. Now, the disciples do not, of course, understand what Jesus means by rising from death. They don't ask about him about it, but they do take the opportunity to ask him about both Elijah mainly about Elijah. And Matthew, in his account, records that they did understand his reference to Elijah coming again to be to John the Baptist, who had already come. And Jesus is perhaps saying that the pattern for his own treatment has come. John, remember, was executed, and Jesus will also be executed. They're left pondering about the Son of Man suffering and being rejected. So that's what happens, this real, very interesting event. But what do we take away from it for ourselves today? Well, I think the first thing is that although we don't need to climb a mountain to do it, we should certainly remember the importance of prayer, especially when we take major decisions in our lives. That was what was happening here, in a way, to Jesus. And we need to follow that pattern of prayer, of making time for it, which is not always easy, but it is necessary. If Jesus needed to take time apart, and he was both man and God, how much more do we need to take time apart, especially when we live in the sort of world that we do, in a busy city? We shouldn't expect to hear God's voice in the same way that Jesus did, perhaps, but we should expect to have some kind of reassurance from him, perhaps some word from a friend or relative to confirms which way we should go if we have difficult decisions to make. The location and time do not matter in themselves for prayer. They should be those that actually work for us. They should enable us to focus our thoughts on God, away from all the concerns that sometimes seem to overwhelm us, to constantly occupy our thoughts. Secondly, we have something to look forward to, and that's the day when God's glory is revealed more fully. The writers of the Old Testament certainly look forward to a new creation where all is at peace, and ultimately so can we. There are moments, aren't there, when someone around us or something in the beauty of creation, we get a glimpse of God. But one day he will not be hidden from us. And although I've no great desire to actually climb mountains, I've enjoyed going up the mountains by other means on various holidays. If you get away from the crowds, it can be especially beautiful. And one day we will, in a sense, live permanently in what we would now describe as a mountainside experience. It will happen. But thirdly, in the meantime, we do need to continue to live our lives on the ground, just as the disciples needed to do when they came down from that mountainside. We need to live with the difficulties of a modern, secular world. We also need to live with at least some unanswered questions, just as the disciples had to. We may be more affected by certain questions than others, but there are always things that we don't fully understand. But we need to face those questions with the faith in a God who created us, who sustains us, who loves us, and whose servants number the hairs on our heads. And then fourthly and finally, we are to tell others what we have seen and experienced, just as Peter was doing when he was permitted to do so. And we have that injunction from Jesus to actually tell others about him, to be his witnesses. And that's not an easy thing either. It won't always have the results that we would wish, but it is his clear command. If the disciples had not witnessed to Christ in the world, then we would never have heard him. Things would have been very different. How would our world have looked today? So in summary, mysterious though it remains, this event, this transfiguration, was a real and timely event for Jesus and his closest disciples. It reminds us of the importance of prayer, It reminds us that we can one day look forward to a day when God's glory is more fully revealed. It reminds us in the meantime we need to live a life of faith with at least some questions unanswered. And it reminds us of our own responsibilities to tell others about him.